From the Sky News Centre at 6, the Home Secretary has raised the chance of an attack on mainland Britain by dissident Irish Republicans from moderate to substantial. It's the first time this threat level has been published to encourage people to be alert. But the danger from international terrorism is still rated severe. Our reporter David Blevins has more from Belfast.
The political institutions here in Northern Ireland have never been so stable for so long. And Republicans who are hardline see that as an indication that their long-held aspiration of a united Ireland has not been achieved.
Actress Lindsay Lohan is back behind bars after a failed drug test. It will be the star's third jail stint for a three-year-old drug and drink driving case filed after two high-profile arrests in 2007. Her father Michael spoke outside the court in LA.
She doesn't stay with her mother when she's home. She stays in a hotel, unsupervised. Is that a good place for her?
No.
It's all people, places, and things. And she's around the wrong people, hanging out in the wrong places, and all the things in her life are misguided.
A postman who used the internet to groom hundreds of children for sex has been jailed for 8.5 years. Michael Williams targeted youngsters he met while delivering post, driving a taxi, and working at a football club in Cornwall. Barack Obama has strongly condemned comments by the Iranian president that implied the US government played a part in 9/11. The US president says Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's remarks at the UN were offensive, hateful and inexcusable. English competitors have spent the day inspecting facilities in Delhi for the Commonwealth Games. Scotland, Northern Ireland and New Zealand have also pledged to attend, but an Australian official says India should never have been made hosts. Indie rockers The Charlatans will play their UK tour dates with The Verve's Pete Salisbury. He's standing in for drummer John Brooks, who's been diagnosed with a brain tumour. Brooks collapsed on stage during a gig in Philadelphia last week and is to undergo surgery. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
BrisFest 2010. Bristol Community FM will be broadcasting live from BrisFest 2010 on the weekend of the 25th and 26th of September.
Come on, come on, come on, come down here to the BrisFest in the heart of town. Yeah. So get yourself online, BrisFest.co.uk. Tickets in advance from only £5 a day. 24 to 26th of September.
FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Pakistani politician Imran Farooq was assassinated in London a week ago. We saw his wife on TV yesterday pleading for information that might help police catch his killers. But who was he? And what did he represent in his party's home base, Karachi? We'll be finding out in a minute. But first, the result of the first round in the Labour Party leadership election will be announced tomorrow. Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist, is joining me now. Martin, can you just give us a sort of brief resume of who you think are the main candidates? And then afterwards, I'll ask you who you think is going to win.
Well, I mean, it's not exactly. Most people in the country probably haven't taken on board who all the different candidates are. So you've got the two Miliband brothers, you've got Ed Balls, you've got Andy Burnham, and you've got Diane Abbott. That's the field, but most people expect one of the Miliband brothers to win.
To what extent do you think, though, that the mainstream press has quite a big influence in these situations? Because you just keep hearing them saying, oh, it's going to be one of the Milibands, you know, these are the front runners. And doesn't that actually encourage Labour Party members and trade union people to actually vote for them?
Well, it does, but I mean, that happens in any election, doesn't it, that people wade in and say who they think was going to win and encourage the idea that certain people are going to win and other people are not going to win and so on. That's part of electioneering, and it's inevitable. Really.
Okay, so what's the spread from is it too simplistic to just look at the left and the right and say
it's not too simplistic. Yeah, I mean it is simplistic because obviously there are differences and nuances, but there is broadly a spectrum from left to right, with Diane Abbott on the left and probably Andy Burnham on the far right. When I say he's on the far right, I mean on the far right of the Labour Party.
So he's right of David Miliband.
Well, I think there's some doubt about this, but Andy Burnham was very much a Blairite in the past, although he started to say some more radical things, because of course this is a Labour Party election, so they have to please the electorate inside the Labour Party. We have trade union activists, and Labour MPs, so it's not an electorate of the whole country. So they have to, you know, they have to say something that's going to keep those kind of people happy. So they all have to, you know, certainly address the audience that they're addressing.
Now, I know you're a bit of a fan, and you even said before that you voted for Diane Abbott. Why Diane Abbott?
I'm not a fan of Diane Abbott. I voted for her. Okay. I voted for her as my first choice because she is the candidate of the left, and I am of the left, and I want to see the strength of the left measured, so that we get some idea what the strength of the left is within the party. I don't think she's going to win. I think that she won't win. But nevertheless, we need to see. I mean, we've got an STV election here. I'm also a great fan of PR, as you know.
STV.
A single transferable vote. Yeah. So in other words, by voting for Diane, I haven't ruled out the possibility of somebody else winning. My second preference can go to somebody else without undermining my first preference. And I think that's actually, you know, if we're going to do that in internal Labour Party elections, perhaps we ought to do it in general elections. It's pretty obvious to me. One of my great disappointments with all of the candidates is there hasn't been a genuinely open commitment to genuine proportional representation. Some of them are in favour of an alternative vote system in the general election, but that's a halfway house. I think, you know, despite that Trevor and the Liberal Democrats having left the studio, I'm very much in favour of PR. And here we are inside the Labour Party using PR for our own election. It's good enough for us, but it's not good enough for the general public. I mean, why is that?
Now, the actual way the election takes place is a little bit complicated, isn't it? It's something called an electoral college. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it's to do with Labour Party history. The Labour Party is a syndicalist party. It's made up of a number of different organisations who've come together to create the party. So the trade unions obviously are a major factor in this. They're the major funders of the party and so on. So they get one third of the votes. The activists and the people who do knock on doors and so on, they get their share, so they get another third of the votes. And the MPs get another third of the vote. So each individual MP, really, their vote counts for an awful lot more in this than an individual party member like myself.
Now, one of the irritating things in the past, at least I've seen about the Labour Party, is this whole trade union block vote system.
And that's not going to happen here. Individual trade union members will get a ballot paper and they can vote according to
their... had a ballot paper.
They've had a ballot paper, yeah. And they're entitled to vote for anybody they want. Their leadership can recommend that they would like them to vote for so-and-so or so-and-so, but they're perfectly at liberty to vote for whoever they want.
Okay, isn't it a two-stage process, or is it just, I mean, if someone's an outright winner tomorrow?
I'm slightly confused because I thought we were going to get the outright winner tomorrow, but maybe I've got it wrong.
No, I don't think so. I think what happens is, you know, it sort of thins the field down a little bit in the first round, and then there's another round.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, I've cast, everybody's already cast all of their ballots. So we're not going to go back to cast another ballot. So it should be possible, it certainly is possible, for them to tell us who's actually won tomorrow if they want to. They may string it out and say, well, on the first round, it would be interesting to know how many votes each candidate got. But I don't think there's going to be another round of voting. So in a sense, you know, all the voting's already happened. So even if we find out that how the votes transferred between the candidates, they could tell us that tomorrow, or they could tell us at the end of the week. But it seems to me that they could tell us tomorrow if they wanted to.
Now, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you what you think of the Labour leadership campaign, and particularly who you think should be the next Labour leader announced tomorrow.
Who should be the next Labour leader?
I think probably Diane Abbott. I know it sounds a bit out there. I think in comparison to people like David Miliband, Ed Miliband, Ed Balls, who seem to have a very big opinion, I think it might be quite nice to have a backbencher actually be the next Labour leader. I think she'd bring some fresh ideas, maybe some more humble ideas to the table if it was the case that Labour... And I think she'd have the best chance out of all of them in making Labour a re-electable party by the next election, rather than David Miliband, who I think would just spout a lot more either Tony Blair or Gordon Brown politics. We don't really know where he stands. I think Diane Abbott would have a much better time making herself clear as to what she stood for.
I really don't have a clue with, like, anything with politics, really, on that type of thing. someone who knows the needs and requirements of the country and has the people at his heart and trying to endeavour to lead us forwards, onwards and upwards, out of recession, into a fantastic future of prosperity for the people of this country. Diane Abbott, because she's forthright, she's intelligent, she's black, so we can follow in the success of America, and it gives hope to everyone in society, taking no notice of creed or colour. So it would be great hope for many people in this country.
I think David Miliband. I think he's the most convincing out of that bunch, actually.
Andy Burnham. He got a very good opinion about how to take care of the country and how to look after the people. He's quite good at it, so I believe he's going to be a good Labour leader for us.
I don't know. Cameron is at the moment, is that right? You're David right. Cameron, that's about all I know.
Who is the most electable as a future Prime Minister?
Diana Abbott or Ed Miliband?
I think also David Miliband.
Despite the fact that I said Diana Abbott, I do think, in more specifically to that question, probably either David Miliband or Ed Balls. I think that although Ed Ball, people laugh at Ed Balls, he might do some good. I think David Miliband, he's the most Blair-esque, and I think that if he could, I think he'd be the one to really push for his image to become the next Prime Minister. He'd be sort of like the next, he'd be the next line in the succession. It'd be like, you know, Tony Blair did it, started it off, and then David Cameron nicked the idea, and now David Miliband, being sort of one of the younger candidates, he'll probably nick the same and nick the ideas and try and push for a new Labour or something like that. So,
well, I can see when he carry himself like, and he has the ability to do the best for the country, I believe. So I'm definitely going for the Andy Burnham, yes, strongly.
Does it matter who's elected leader?
I think it does. I think you need someone who has the experience to motivate, encourage and lead his fellow party members to the future.
Yes, it does matter, yeah. Because it's just going to be not the leader on sitting on the chair, because he's going to also change the people's opinion towards the other. So I strongly believe that it does matter.
Who was the best ever Labour leader?
Best ever Labour leader? I mean, typically I would probably say Tony Blair, but the only reason, because I think he was actually a pretty good Prime Minister, despite the legacy that he left in places like Iraq and things like that. I just think that sort of really does overshadow a lot of the really good stuff that he did, the peace talks in Northern Ireland, pushing America to get involved in the Kosovo war. I think that he did a lot of good during his time as Prime Minister. But I don't think, as a Labour leader, I think that as a party that was very much still supposed to be socialist, I think that I'm too young, I think, to really be able to remember. I know, I don't think I qualify to answer that question.
Harold Wilson.
Well, I'm going to say Neil Kinnock, and I bet a lot of people haven't said that, because he modernised the Labour Party. A lot of people realise that he did that.
Tony Blair, definitely Tony Blair, yeah. He gave a lot to this country, his own hard work, and he's still giving it, even though he's an ex-Prime Minister, but still, he has still proteus him to the United Kingdom and his party as well. Definitely Tony Blair.
I thought Tony Blair was pretty good in his first couple of terms, yeah. I thought, yeah, Tony Blair.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with that as well. Tony Blair, in his first little stint. Maybe not in the second one, but yeah, Tony Blair.
Well, there's lots of big Tony Blair fans there, Martin. Are you surprised to hear that?
Not really. I mean, as they said, it's in his first stint, he wasn't doing too bad a job, was he?
So who do you think is going to be able to it seems like 4 p.m. tomorrow is the time they're announcing the leader. And it's too close to call, according to the BBC, between Ed Miliband and David Miliband. Is there really much difference between these two brothers?
I think there is, yeah. I think there is, because if Ed Miliband hadn't stood, then there would have been a David Miliband coronation. But because Ed Miliband is so like David, but not... It's actually become a contest. And a contest is good for the party.
Is there no real competition within the Labour Party? Because obviously David Miliband is a new Labour candidate. Is there no real sort of obvious old Labour style candidate?
Well, I mean, you could argue that Diane Abbott represents the old Labour tradition. I'm not happy with her position on PR, but then I'm not happy with...
This is the voting system.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think the fact that it is very close between David and Ed shows that it's a real competition. It's and as it should be.
In the country is one thing, but in London, Ken Livingstone has defeated today former MP Una King for Labour's nomination for the 2012 London mayoral election. Livingstone served two terms as London mayor between 2000 and 2008 and has polled 68.8 of the total votes. So do you think this is going to have any bearing on it? Because, I mean, he's obviously a very popular candidate for London, Ken.
Yeah, well, he's popular amongst Labour activists.
Within the Labour Party,
Within the Labour Party. But, I mean, to be honest with you, in another universe different from this one, perhaps Ken Livingstone would be on the verge of being Labour leader as we speak. But, of course, the infighting within the party in the past has meant that that was not possible. I think there's every possibility that Ed Miliband will win as an upset, because this is not a normal electorate. This is an electorate of Labour activists who've got a very specific mindset. They want to see somebody who will lead the party from its heart as well as from its head.
Apparently 3 million people are expected to have voted in this leadership contest, which is quite an amazing quantity. But Andy Burnham, who's one of the candidates, has called today for a change in the rules for future leadership contests with tighter spending limits. I wouldn't have thought that, I would imagine that these Labour people wouldn't have had massive budgets to campaign, but I suppose it makes a difference.
It does make a difference. I mean, David Miliband has had a lot more money than anybody else. I don't suppose it's decisive in this kind of election, but nevertheless, the question is, you see, in other political parties like the Liberal Democrats or the Conservatives, every individual party member gets a vote, and the MPs have to put up with what the party.
This is exactly what Andy Burnham is saying. He's saying that there should be a change in the way that these elections take place, particularly the anomaly between party members, trade unionists, and the MPs themselves. He says, "I don't see why my vote as an MP is worth 600 times the vote of an ordinary party member. That's not how we build a mass membership party," he told The Guardian.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because in actual fact, the MPs actually act as a kind of a brake on the radical instincts of the rank and file. And if we did have one person, one vote inside the Labour Party, Diane Abbott might win hands down. But of course, the party is a coalition of forces, and the MPs get the one third of the vote under the current electoral system because they are regarded as, you know, basically an elite of leaders who they have to trust whoever it is who is chosen, and that's the logic behind it. But of course, you could argue, as Andy's arguing there, that it's not democratic. But democratising parties can be quite an interesting process, because you don't actually end up with a you often end up with more radical rather than less radical candidates.
Okay, thanks very much, Martin. And so we'll see the result 4 p.m. tomorrow. Just one last little point that occurs to me. Why is it it's taken such a long time? This election seems to have been strung out really since the general election. That's about 4 months.
Well, some are saying that it's been too quick and that we ought to have taken longer over it and got it right.
Well, I mean, if elections take a long periods of time, as we know, as we were looking at electoral fraud last week, it can mean that votes get messed around with, ballot papers get interfered with. It seems a very, surely there's something that you should do almost,
any election is bound to have, you need a campaign of some length so that people can listen to the arguments and see who the candidates are. But you don't want it to go on and on and on and on and on. You want a result so that the country does need the opposition leader to be in place to argue as we go forward. And, what could be a very, very difficult 6 months. You know, we could have, let's be absolutely blunt, we could have a collapse on Wall Street and a war with Iran before next spring. And we need a Labour leader who can actually address those kind of issues if they come over the horizon.
Right, well, our next story is also looking at the Middle East. The Israeli raid on the Gaza aid flotilla, which, remember from earlier this year, has broken the law. This is the results of a probe by the United Nations. This was a BBC story. The raid on the Mavi Marmara, of course, which two Bristolians were on board, resulted in the deaths of 9 pro-Palestinian activists. Israel's military broke international laws during its raid on the Gaza-bound aid flotilla, a UN Human Rights Council investigation has said. The 3-member panel said the Israeli commando's response to the flotilla was disproportionate and betrayed an unacceptable level of brutality. In a 56-page report, the UN panel also said that there is clear evidence to support prosecutions of the following crimes within the the terms of Article 147 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Willful killing, torture or inhuman treatment, willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health. Now, Martin, what do you think is the impact of this? Because although it hasn't made much of a big sound on the news internationally, I think maybe that's because there are several of these inquiries going on at the same time, and we're still waiting to hear the results of the Israeli inquiry.
Well, I mean, it's unsurprising that the UN has concluded that this action was illegal, because it patently was illegal. But I don't think anything will happen as a result of this, because the Israelis have basically thumbed their nose at the international community for many years, and I don't suppose they're going to change that policy now.
So what's the point of the United Nations if, when they do an investigation like this and decide something is illegal, then nothing happens?
I think, you know, condemnation of evil acts is better than saying nothing. You know, they shouldn't imagine that there's just going to be silence when they carry out illegal and evil acts. But one has to be realistic and recognise that, you know, condemnation is one thing and action to do something about it is something completely different.
What about the siege of Gaza, which ship was trying to break the blockade of Gaza itself? Do you think there's are there any prospects of the current peace talks which are going on to actually break that siege and to bring peace?
No, because Hamas have been excluded from the talks quite deliberately, even though they're the elected government of Palestine. And that is why these talks will go nowhere.
Well, I mean, what the Israeli side, of course, will argue, and the Americans on that, is that this is a terrorist government, basically, the Hamas government.
Well, the Hamas would argue that the United States and Israel are terrorist governments. It's pretty much the same kind of argument we went through for 30 years in Northern Ireland, isn't it? Until sense prevailed. Basically, you can't exclude people from discussions if you want to make peace with them. If you exclude them, then obviously their position is going to be, well, we're not playing ball, are we?
Well, we had the former BBC Panorama and ITN foreign correspondent who knew many of the people, the senior figures over the last 30, 40 years in Alan Hart on this programme at the end of last year. And he had a pretty grim assessment of the situation. Yeah. He was saying that there was really nothing was going to sort this situation out. Are you of that view, or do you think that there are some hopes for peace there?
One would like to be optimistic, but it's very hard to be optimistic given the current circumstances. The Israeli government is pretty much dug into a non-constructive policy. The only thing that might change their minds is if a US president was determined to make peace happen, but it's very difficult for US presidents to do that because the lobby in favour of Israel inside the United States is extremely powerful. So it's a snooker situation, really. But of course, it's a very painful situation for the people on the receiving end. That is to say, the Palestinian people have been denied justice for many decades now.
Right, thanks. Well, moving to Karachi now, and there have been riots in Karachi and actually several people killed as well, and as a result of the death last week in London of a Pakistani politician, Imran Farooq. He was assassinated in London a week ago. His wife was on television yesterday pleading for information that might help police catch his killers. But who was this chap, and what did he represent in his party's home base, Karachi? Martin, can you just give us a bit of insight into how this has affected Pakistani politics? Because it's pretty horrific, isn't it, to have an assassination actually taking place on the streets of London?
Well, it's horrific to have it happening on the streets of London, but of course such things are daily occurrences inside Pakistan, sadly.
Is this something we're going to have to get used to, do you think?
I'm afraid Britain is part of, because of our international connections and our history, people are going to bring their struggles to our streets, I'm afraid.
Now, he was one of the original founders, many decades ago, of the fourth biggest party in Pakistan.
Yeah, and the party, MQM, represents Pakistanis who were essentially, you know, ethnically cleansed, if you like, from India and ended up in Karachi. And that's their political power base.
What might be the object of an assassination of somebody like this?
Well, though? I mean, don't forget that inside Pakistan itself, daily atrocities are carried out. many people inside Pakistan point fingers in all kinds of directions. I mean, in this country, we get a very kind of stereotypical, oh, yes, the Taliban are the problem in Pakistan. Now, leaving aside the fact that there are at least four factions inside the Taliban in Pakistan, many people, educated people in Pakistan, also point to the Indians interfering, to the Americans interfering, and to the Israelis interfering. You say Israelis interfering in Pakistan? Yes, yes, Pakistan has nuclear weapons.
Well,
it's
actually,
the only Muslim state which has, and I'm afraid that Pakistan has now become a place where everybody else settles their struggles and differences. It's got a very big strategic role, and everybody is basically trying to destabilize Pakistan.
Now,
and this, I would see this, whoever has carried it out, this assassination, as part of that process of destabilizing Pakistan.
Is that sort of part of a process of regime change, or is it bombing them back to the Stone Age?
I think it's to do with the major factor underlying it all, in fact, in my view, is that the Chinese have always been in alliance with the Pakistani regime under both military and democratic governments. And they want to build an oil pipeline from Iran through Pakistan to China. Now, that would mean that China would have access to oil, which was not interdictable by the US Navy. Yeah? So, in other words, that would immeasurably increase China's strategic position. The Americans are determined that that pipeline shall not be built, and that may explain an awful lot of the destabilisation that's going on.
Because, of course, we saw a couple of years ago the murder of Benazir Bhutto. I mean, it seems like quite a lot of the most switched on and in many ways fairly moderate politicians in Pakistan are under threat of their lives.
Well, I mean, it's very hard when an incident happens like the assassination of Benazir or of this gentleman to know exactly who did it. Especially when we haven't got access to the information that would help us to come to such conclusions. I think many in Pakistan, and I think rightly, suspect that their country is being destabilised by foreign powers. And I would just appeal to everybody to show calm. The way to defeat this kind of terrorist atrocity is to make sure that nothing changes as a result of what's happened, that policy does not switch, that people stick to their guns, whatever their guns are. I don't mean their literal guns, I mean their political guns, and that whoever carries out an assassination like this does not achieve their political goals.
Okay, now, just before 5:30, we're going to have another quick look back at the speech yesterday by President Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, at the United Nations. I'm going to take a couple of extracts out of it, Martin, and just get your comments on those. One of the things he said, and in fact, it was actually quite difficult, even watching it on the TV, to actually hear what the translator was saying, because they had him speaking in I think, is it Farsi,
yeah,
at the same volume, roughly, as the translations was. And also, at one point during the speech, he was so dissatisfied with the way that the translators were operating that he actually stopped his speech and made a protest about the way the translation was being handled at the United Nations. Anyway, one of the things that he said was, as a result of the two world wars, the occupation of Palestine, the Korean and the Vietnam wars, the Iraqi war against Iran, the occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as many wars in Africa, hundreds of millions of people were killed, wounded or displaced. Terrorism, illicit drugs, poverty and the social gaps increased. The dictatorial and coup d'etat governments in Latin America committed unprecedented crimes with the support of the West. Instead of disarmament, this proliferation and stockpiling of nuclear, biological and chemical weapons expanded, putting the world under a bigger threat. And as a result, the very same old goals of colonialists and the slave masters were, this time round, pursued with a new facade.
Well, I mean, people go on about how crazy Ahmadinejad is, but frankly, that is actually how many people in the world see the West. They don't see it as a beacon of light and freedom. They see it as a purveyors of imperialism and violence. And it's hard to disagree. What happens is that our media basically misinforms us about our own history. So the destruction of Angola and Mozambique in the 1980s by the Thatcher and Reagan regimes, where millions of people were killed, starved, brutalized in order to prevent, you know, what were regarded as unacceptable regimes from pursuing their policies. That is our track record. And it's no use the West turning around saying, yes, but we're the good guys. In our own minds, we're the good guys, but that's not how we're perceived in the world at large. Ahmadinejad is just saying what many others think.
Another quote, it was said, from this is Ahmadinejad here, it was said that some 3,000 people were killed on the 11th of September, for which we are all very saddened. Yet, up until now, in Afghanistan and Iraq, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, millions wounded and displaced, and the conflict is still going on and expanding.
Well, again, I mean, leaving aside the question of who carried out 9/11, we did discuss that a little bit in the early part of the show, and in any case, we've frequently covered that topic on this show, as you know, Tony. Let's say that some terrorist group outside the United States did carry it out, which I don't accept for a moment. Let's just imagine that it did. But clearly, the revenge has been disproportionate. Whole societies have been plunged into absolute chaos, millions of displaced people, millions of casualties. It's totally disproportionate. Even if the attack were genuine, the response has been totally disproportionate. It's hard to disagree, isn't it? And don't forget that Iran was attacked by Iraq at the West's instigation in 1980.
Thanks, Martin. Now, at the bottom of Park Street, behind the council house and the Mauritania, is an anonymous light-coloured stone building. Some evenings, men can be seen going in, sometimes looking furtively over their shoulders to see if anyone's watching them. The Freemasons are a mysterious bunch, but journalist Martin Short dug out a tremendous amount for his disturbing book, Inside the Brotherhood. Here he is, talking with another Freemason and Robert Lomas.
Hello. When I was growing up, I became aware that there was a part of my father's life from which I was excluded. Much of that life revolved around his work, his family and the church. But there was a regular meeting which was a grey area. Later I learned that he was a Freemason. He never explained it to me, never invited me to join, which was probably just as well, since I felt no inclination. So the arcane secrets of Freemasonry have remained that to me to this day. Joining me to discuss Freemasonry are Dr. Robert Lomas, a lecturer at Bradford University and the author of many books on Freemasonry, including Turning the Hiram Key, Martin Short, a TV documentary producer and journalist and author of Inside the Brotherhood, Further Secrets of the Freemasons, and John Acaster, former church warden at Manchester Cathedral and past president of the Manchester Association for Masonic Research. So, Robert, if I wanted to become a Freemason, what must I do?
You have to ask. If you don't express an interest, nobody will ask you. So the lodge, your local lodges will run gavel nights where they invite you in to have a look around the temple and see what they do. But if you want to become a Mason, you must ask.
Is there a creed I would have to sign up to?
No.
But I would have to sign up to a belief in some sort of supreme being.
You must express a belief in supreme being. And if you can't express a belief in supreme being, then Freemasonry is not for you.
So what is the definition of a supreme being?
The definition of supreme being is something that you decide for yourself. And you then say you believe or you don't believe. Now, my definition of supreme being is taken from Newton's Principia Mathematica. Newton said that the supreme being is the most wise and excellent contrivance of things and final causes. And that's really confirmed by Einstein, whose definition I also like, who said, the harmony of natural law, which reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared with all the systematic thinking and acting of human beings, it is an utterly insignificant reflection.
It sounds like a fairly wide definition, but let me ask you one further question. Is Freemasonry, in your view, a benevolent influence in society?
Yes, it's a good influence in society.
Martin, what led you to research the Freemasons and write your book?
Well, it certainly wasn't Freemasonry's delusion that it's a beneficial force in society. In the 1960s, I got involved in investigating corruption in local government and in the police. And lo and behold, it turned out that large numbers of police officers who were at it, on the take, were all Freemasons. What's more, in several lodges, they were colleagues of convicted criminals who, in some cases, practiced the same kind of crime as these officers were meant to be pursuing. In other words, you had a lodge where there was a superintendent whose job it was to scour the bookshops of Soho and rid it of pornography, and he had inducted into his own lodge a pornographer. And the same goes for a lodge which had bank robbers and people whose job it was to catch bank robbers. So it didn't seem to me that this was in fact quite the moral society that it had portrayed itself. In fact, these corrupt yet deemed elite Scotland Yard squads were almost entirely composed in Freemasons. Indeed, you had to be a Freemason in order to join them, because that was another bond of secrecy.
John, let me ask you, as a Christian, is Freemasonry a religion?
No, Freemasonry does not claim in any way to be a religion. It assists religion. It is a handmaid to religion. It practices, in what it does, religious principles of piety and virtue, as it would put. And it is very supportive to good aims of religion, particularly Christianity, but other religions as well. There isn't a monopoly in any one religion of goodness.
So what is its specific appeal to a Christian?
Its specific appeal to a Christian is that it is filled with the fruits of the Holy Spirit.
Well, I'd like, first of all, to look at the origins of this movement we call Freemasonry. When was the first lodge created in England, Robert?
The first lodge we have a record of in England is in 1646, which is the initiation of Elias Ashmole in Warrington. But that was a long-existing lodge. If you wanted a better opinion on it, I would suggest it was probably about 1603, when James VI came down to England as James I, because he'd been initiated into the Lodge of School in Perth 2 years earlier.
So why did they call themselves Masons? What was the link to stonemasons?
They call themselves Masons because the entire credo and myth of Freemasonry is based upon the building of a spiritual temple. You become a living stone in the temple of society.
But these weren't people who worked in stone themselves.
No, they were speculative masons who considered the effect of certain philosophical tools upon their own morals, and so they called themselves speculative or Freemasons. They weren't actual builders.
And John, why did they call them lodges?
Lodges is the traditional term applied to operative Freemasons. And when we have been speaking about the origins of Freemasonry in that way, modern thinking actually does link operative Freemasons with speculative Freemasons in the development of what is now purely speculative Freemasonry.
Martin, do you buy that?
The thing about these lodges, which were most of them created in the 17th century, there were one or two examples maybe of ones that had somehow taken over some sort of derelict stonemason's lodge, but I mean the thing is they ripped out all the major religious elements of those lodges' basic tenets. I mean, you've got to look at the medieval cathedral builders' lodges as being basically like chapels of a trade union. These believed in the Holy Trinity. They had references, obviously, to Jesus in them, and of course they were also Catholic, and none of these apply to the ersatz institutions which were created in the 17th century as Freemasonry.
Robert?
I'm afraid you're talking absolute nonsense. The earliest reference to a Masonic lodge occurs in the minutes of Aberdeen Council in 1483, and there was a lot of cathedral building going on in those days, and that's dated to the earliest example of Masonic symbolism, the Kirkwall Scroll.
Sorry,
The symbolism goes right the way back to the very beginning. They weren't all created in the 1700s, it just came to England at that time. There's continuous minutes from the Lodge of Edinburgh from 1599, and they were not builders. They were speculative masons.
The connection with the medieval cathedral builders is indeed mythical. I mean,
no, it's quite positive.
You've said yourself...
It's recorded in council minutes and in Masonic...
Said these are speculative masons, the ones you've just...
No, I said the ones who were building St. Nicholas's Kirk in Aberdeen were working masons.
Yeah, well, were they...
And they took on speculative masons with them.
These were also, of course, Catholics, and therefore their religious...
Building St. Nicholas's Kirk, Catholics? Come on, Martin.
In 1483, you may recall that this actually predated the Reformation. Therefore, these people were Catholics.
I'll accept that as a technical point.
Let's go back to the primal myth of Freemasonry, the biblical story, the building of Solomon's temple. Now, speculative Masons use the allegory and the myth that arises from that story. But does anybody actually believe that the links of that time are true?
I don't think Solomon's temple actually existed. But the myth goes back further, because the beginning of the Masonic myth is in the Temple of Enoch. And reputedly, the prophet Enoch carved the secrets of that were passed on to Freemasonry on two pillars. These he supposedly buried in a chamber. The people clearing the ground for Solomon's temple found this chamber, took out the pillars, reiterated the secrets, passed them on to Solomon, Hiram, king of Tyre, and Hiram Abiff. When Solomon's temple was destroyed, the temple of Zerubbabel was built upon that site. And eventually you get down to the Christian degrees of Freemasonry, including the degrees of Knight Templar, and that concerns the ruins of Herod's temple, where again these secrets were reburied.
But that's esoteric mumbo-jumbo, Robert, isn't it? Nobody seriously believes that that sort of chain of command of passing down actually existed.
No, it's the myth, and it's the myth that Freemasonry is built upon.
So what's the purpose of that sort of myth and allegory?
The myth is that if you build yourself into a shaped and living stone, and you fit into the temple in the correct manner, then society as a whole will benefit from
it. And as I understand it, there are three things that have to be present at a Masonic ceremony. There's the compass, there's the square, and what you call the volume of the sacred law, which is a holy book. Why call it the volume of the sacred law?
It's not necessarily a holy book. It's the volume of the sacred law for you. And in fact, the book that my lodge opens for me is Principia Mathematica. I assume John will prefer to have a Bible open as well.
Yes, I mean, the general tradition in England clearly is that a Bible in some form or other is open. If it's largely composed of Jewish brethren, of course it is the Old Testament. If otherwise, it is the Two Testaments. If it is a Muslim, then it is the Quran. It is whatever is the sacred book to the faith of the individual brother who's being initiated.
What about the induction ceremony, which is the butt of many jokes? And as I understand it, when I...
Shall I roll up my trouser leg?
Well, I was about to say you'd have to roll up your trouser leg. As I understand it, you'd have to roll up one sleeve.
And
you'd have to bare your breast.
Yes, you have to bare your left breast. Well, you carry on?
You are doing it. I can confirm that you're doing it. But it also, as I understand it, involves daggers, and some would tell you,
yes.
Go.
So it's basically good-natured humour. You say to people, well, you've heard all these tales. We really are going to subject you to this, but you're not really.
Good-natured humour, Martin?
Well, I find it all wholly fatuous. I can't understand why anybody these days, let alone,
I'm sure you couldn't.
Let alone several hundred years ago, would submit themselves to these rituals and bind themselves in loyalty to people who, at the point of joining, they have no idea who they're joining. I mean, men who may have committed all sorts of sins and crimes in other walks of life, and suddenly you're bound in a union of mutual support and defence. I mean, it just seems to me to be absolutely ridiculous.
John?
Freemasonry does not consist of anyone. It consists of people who are initiated. In relation to taking of oaths, clearly you have to have reliance upon the integrity of those who are inviting you to do that. In my case, that certainly has been the case and has not been misled.
If it was such a movement of integrity, what is the need for the secrecy? Because up to the 1980s, when a member joined, he had to swear these oaths, and there were horrendous punishments.
Oh, yes. Your throat cut across, your tongue torn from the roots, and your body buried in the rough sands of the sea whence the tide does pass twice in the course of a natural day.
So why would that sort of threat have to hang over the head of a Mason?
If you'd actually stood up in London in 1717 and said you were a Freemason, because Freemasonry at that time was connected with Jacobitism and the Stuarts, you would effectively be asking for the penalty of the third degree to be carried out on you, which would be hanging, drawing and quartering. And that was carried out by the civil authorities at the time. So it wasn't something that was peculiar to Freemasonry. It's just that Freemasonry has kept them in because they're quite dramatic and they add a little bit of fun of the ritual.
Well, I want to discuss in a moment or two the contemporary relevance of Freemasonry, but let me remind you that you're listening to Beyond Belief, and today we're discussing the Freemasons, and with me are Robert Lomas and John Acaster, who are both members of the Masonic Order, and Martin Short, who is definitely not. At one time, a considerable number of the Anglican clergy were Freemasons. Whether that's still true is a matter of uncertainty, but the number has reduced over the years. John Lawrence is an Anglican priest. He comes from a family of Freemasons, and he kept an open mind on the subject when he first began his career.
Yes, I was in banking for about 10 years, and each of the managers that I served under was in Freemasonry. One or two of them knew my relations and so on, and further hints were dropped about joining. And when eventually I came out of banking, I decided that I would research Freemasonry from my own personal point of view, just to see why there was this feeling of unease about joining.
When you were in banking, there must have been a sense that those who were Freemasons stood a better chance of gaining promotion than those who were not.
Oh yes, I remember very clearly that one sub-manager that I was working under one day suddenly announced that he was joining Freemasonry and that from now on his career would really take off, and he said that very openly. And I suppose at certain times you realise that others who were Freemasons, they very often got quite favourable treatment with regard to overdrafts and loans and so on.
You've mentioned that after you left banking, you decided you were going to investigate further. What prompted that?
Well, I was at Theological College in Bristol. And in fact, I decided that I would do a study of Christianity and Freemasonry, partly from an academic point of view, but also, really, I think, to satisfy my own, not so much curiosity, but concern as to whether it really was a good idea for me to join.
And what conclusions did you come to? Is it compatible with Christianity?
Definitely not. I think there are profound difficulties for anyone who is a Christian to sign up for Freemasonry.
What are those difficulties?
Well, I think the first one really is when you are first initiated, that effectively you're giving a blank check to secrecy. You swear on the Bible that you will not disclose any of the secrets of Freemasonry, but you don't know what those are. But further than that, I think as you go through, you realise that there is a sort of pathway of spirituality which leads to the supreme secret about the great architect of the universe and the name of God, but all the way along, that Jesus and the Holy Spirit are quite specifically left out. And of course, if you're Christian, then Christ's teaching is that he is the way to God. He's the only way to God. And so for him to be excluded, you have a prima facie case, therefore, the two not being compatible.
What advice would you give to a clergyman who's involved in Freemasonry?
Really, to think through the whole issues of compatibility. I think that really, in many ways, that someone who does belong is betraying Christ. And certainly, after I wrote the book, I had around 400 letters which confirmed my feelings entirely about this. And many people wrote to me saying, thank you for letting me know, particularly people who had just entered into Freemasonry and didn't realise what was coming afterwards.
That was the Reverend John Lawrence. And John Acaster, his basic conclusion is that Freemasonry is incompatible with Christianity. Is he right?
I'm afraid to say he isn't, really, because the essence of Christianity lies in doing what is good by the Holy Spirit. It does not mean to say that one is restricted to having to preach Christ at people or to exclude yourself from the company of those who are not members of the Christian Church. Freemasonry is nothing if it is not a wide body which brings in the qualities of goodness that exist among people of all faiths.
There is a sense, Martin, in which a philosophy that embraces all religions, that is extremely tolerant, is very appropriate for a multicultural tolerant society.
Yes, but a multicultural tolerant society is itself the vehicle whereby that tolerance can be expressed. You don't have to go through Freemasonry. You know, that's like saying you have to go from London to Penzance via the Orkney Islands. It's absolutely unnecessary. If you wish to live in a multicultural society and you wish to mix with people of other communities, the last thing you need is to do it through Freemasonry, which in turn requires the sacrifice and trimming of a lot of the basic beliefs of your religion, as John Lawrence explained in terms of Christianity.
Can I make you a statement from Masonic Ritual, which actually talks about this?
Well, you can cite bits of Masonic Ritual, but they are there. They are frequently more honoured in the breach than in the observance.
John Ancaster.
I should just like to make a very important point in relation to all this, that Freemasonry does not worship in its ceremonies. Freemasonry implores the assistance of God upon the good works that it tries to do and upon those who come within it, to make them do good works and become better people themselves. It is not to do with worship. Worship is for the church, it is for the synagogue, it is for the mosque. Freemasonry implores the goodness of God to aid its endeavours for the individual, all of the individuals, and for what it can do as a movement. But, and that's what it does,
Martin.
But the individual doesn't need to go through Freemasonry to achieve any of these aims. Or each of these religions has their own moral code, which are open to anybody to join. The problem about Freemasonry is you have to pass through this sort of esoteric mumbo-jumbo in order to reach some plateau of new morality, as if there is some higher morality within Freemasonry.
I mean, no such suggestion at all. That's your concept on it, and you're not actually a Freemason. You've never even tried it.
I don't have to participate in these activities in order to be able to reach some conclusions of what they're about, especially because many of my sources are Freemasons.
A lot of people who stand outside Freemasonry suspect that what it's all about is mutual self-help. And I know that 20 years ago, when I was in Northern Ireland, there was a bishopric was up for grabs, and the favoured candidate was passed over. It was suspected because he was not a Mason, and it was certainly true that a Mason who was, in most people's beliefs, a much less capable candidate was appointed. That sort of thing did go on, Robert.
I admit certain things have gone on in the past, but it's not because Freemasonry was set up to do that. Freemasonry expressly forbids that. You actually take an oath that you will not use it in that way. Because people misuse it, people misuse all sorts of organisations.
There is a suspicion that that sort of abuse is endemic, that the mutual self-help ideal is bedded deep in Freemasonry.
This view has only appeared in the last couple of generations since Freemasonry stopped telling people what it was about. If you go back to the earlier stages, now, no, Martin doesn't like me using historical references, but it set up the Royal Society. It was the major force in creating the Constitution of the United States. It's been a very powerful and formative force in creating democracy and modern science.
Martin.
Well, I would simply point out that if we wish to go down the route of the American Revolution, then here we have an example of people who had sworn, according to Freemasonry, that they owed loyalty to the temporal powers of their country, and then they set about overthrowing it and causing a revolution. And also, in terms of the Royal Society, Lomas seems to be talking as if anyone who is not a Freemason could not possibly be a decent scientist. I mean, you're making it sound as if the only people who helped create the major advances in this country are Freemasons, and I'm simply saying that cannot possibly be true.
Well, clearly, if I can just come in on this, anyone can assist society, and it is not by any means only those amongst Freemasons who do so, clearly. But for anyone who rubs shoulders with Freemasons at all, it must be clearly borne upon them that such people are actually virtuous and good. They are not corrupt. If there are a few amongst them that are corrupt, they are expelled from the order when it comes to light, and we're very strict on that. We ought to look at it at the big picture. The big picture is, above all, that by their fruit ye shall know them. And the ethos within Freemasonry engenders its fruit. However it is created, and it is created partly through secrecy, it engenders its fruit, which are the fruits of the Spirit, as I referred to before.
But the secrecy is bound to fuel suspicion that there is something not quite right here.
Why should that be so? This is merely a detail of the whole. There's secrecy in all sorts of things. There's secrecy in your life and in mine. That doesn't mean to say that we are improper in the use of it. What are these secrets that belong to Freemasonry? They are nothing of power. They are mere passwords, mere modes of recognition within degrees, generally speaking. We have no esoteric knowledge about other people. Freemasons haven't made themselves rich. You only have to look around at myself or anyone else. We are not in it for money. We are in it because it speaks to us as human beings in the round. It makes you, as my wife rather amusingly says, a more rounded person. And she means it in spiritual terms as well as in physical ones, I'm glad to say.
But if I'm in a meeting and there's a tricky point of negotiation going on, and I see two members of that meeting exchanging a peculiar handshake and knowing glance, I will feel that the scales are loaded against me.
Well, I'm sorry you should feel that way, and I can understand why you might feel that way, but Freemasons are not in the business of trying to lift each other up. They are in the business of being upright and moral. This is the reason why we have the tools that we have. But if I might say so, the quality of Freemasonry and the reason why it has survived over the centuries as it has is that within its meetings and outside it, there is love, joy, peace, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. If we live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit. Let us have no self-conceit, no provoking of one another, no envy of one another. And that's from Galatians, and we live by that in Freemasonry.
Sounds good, Martin.
Well, I don't know why you have to go through Freemasonry to read Galatians. I mean, there is nothing that you can achieve through Freemasonry that you cannot achieve through other means. All these secrets and mysteries are merely diversions from truths that you can reach by other routes. This is simply a way of getting a jolly off every month or so, seeing a load of lads, having a good drink, and generally just sort of cavorting.
You are entitled to your opinion, Martin, and I I uphold your right to be mistaken.
It's an opinion that also seems to be confirmed by a lot of church leaders. We know that the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, has expressed his doubt whether Christians should be members of the Freemasons. We know that Methodism is very opposed to it.
And they're quite entitled to be opposed to it, but it doesn't stop Freemasonry acting as a very tolerant order. Let me just quote from the ritual. No one truly obeys the Masonic law who merely tolerates those whose religious opinions are opposed to their own. Everyone's opinions are their own private property, and the rights of all to maintain such are perfectly equal. That is the teaching of Freemasonry. It is tolerant.
That is, if I might just say so, the teaching of a particular branch of Freemasonry, not the general Freemasonry. Nonetheless, I wouldn't dissent from it generally. The esoteric element of Freemasonry can be expressed in one line, really. It is about the knowledge of God contracted in the square. And that, in one sentence, expresses the compression of thought, uprightness, equality, and keeping within bounds with all mankind that we try to follow in our lives, and going to Freemasonic meetings reinforces our practice and thoughts about divinity and about ourselves.
You used a Masonic term there, John, the square. What is that?
The square is simply an instrument used commonly in building in order to get a divine truth of regularity, and that is something which we honour.
Perfectly squared blocks fit together to form a society, whereas rough blocks do not.
How do you address Martin's point that this is really a glorified boys' club, lads together?
It's also very successful amongst women, and in fact women's Freemasonry is thriving even more successfully, so it's hardly a lads' club.
But you don't allow women to join the same lodges as men?
No, because there are certain parts of the ritual where you bare both breasts, which ladies may not be inclined to. I speak regularly at ladies' lodges, but they don't invite me into the ceremonies.
That's surely not the primary reason.
The reason is that the lodges have been set up separately and they have never mixed, and it is mainly because of modesty, I suspect. There is a whole movement of co-masons which do mix together. I personally would not like to join it. I suspect my wife would be much more suspicious about me going to lodge if I did.
Martin?
Those co-masonic and female masonic lodges have very small numbers. We're talking about minuscule numbers.
No, we're not. We're talking about well over 1,000 lodges in the UK, and with an average of about 50 or 60 members each. I speak regularly to them, Martin.
I assure you that there are not that many.
However many Lady Freemasons there may or may not be, it is a great compliment to male masonry that they have taken up and understand the virtue in what we do.
Well, as we bring this programme to a close, let me ask one final question. In what has become, most of us, a degree, a more open, less secretive society, persuade me that there's any point in Freemasonry, Robert.
It provides a spiritual path, it provides a spiritual teaching which enables you to share the things which are very difficult to put into words, the transcendental mystery at the centre of life. And it enables a physicist to sit down with a Jew, a Muslim to sit down with a Christian, a Jain to sit down with a Zarathustrian. And they can share, through the symbolism and through the shared myth, the secrets of what we are about, why we are here, and what we're doing.
Martin.
How sad it is that someone's social life should be so restricted that the only way he can meet people of other faiths is through Freemasonry. All these options are open to you, all these paths of enlightenment, all these moral planes to which you can soar are available to you through mixing with these people anyway. You don't have to go through Freemasonry.
I agree with you, but why deny me Freemasonry?
I'm not trying to deny you Freemasonry.
You are. It's
just this evangelical thrust that you have. Presumably, if all the world were Freemasons, life would be absolutely wonderful.
John?
Freemasonry promotes tolerance and respect and provides empathy between men. There is no society like it. It is a genuinely brilliant society which everybody ought to belong to who is good.
Well, there we must leave it. My thanks to Robert Lomas, Martin Short and John.
And Martin Short's book is called Inside the Brotherhood. If you'd like to find out more, there's also on the internet a documentary called Rights and Wrongs. That's R-I-T-E-S, Rights and Wrongs, which is a documentary about Gloucestershire Freemasons, which was filmed by HTV back in 1999 as part of their West Eye View series. Now, so yes, and the other thing that was mentioned there was that Rowan Williams, who's the current Archbishop of Canterbury, was very opposed to people joining the Freemasons. But interestingly enough, if you have a little look at Rowan Williams, just after he became the Archbishop of Canterbury back in 2002, he himself went through an hour-long Masonic-style initiation into the Druid Order. Anyway, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2. Thanks very much to our guests, Lib Dem Councillor for Clifton, Trevor Blythe, and Richard Cowley for his report on the Tesco demonstration. Thanks also to Maria Morris and resident Old Labour economist Martin Summers. Next week, Mark Brain.
The community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody...